Hi, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. An hour is short, so welcome. Thank you for coming. I'm Susie Sosa. I'll be your pilot today. I just want to let everybody know this panel is on design for social innovation and public good. And in case there's been any confusion, when we're talking about design, this is, design as a methodology, design as a process, maybe not so much design in terms of app design or some of the ways that it might have been used in other sessions. I just don't want anyone to be disappointed or surprised. Now's a good time to escape, if that's not what you had in mind. But welcome. So as I mentioned, we're going to be talking a lot today about how you can use the methodology and approaches traditionally referred to as design for the benefit of solving public problems. And we're very lucky to have three expert practitioners with us today to talk about their experience and perspectives and to field your questions. At the far end of the table is Barbara Brown Wilson, who's the director of the UT Austin Center for Sustainable Development. She's also an assistant professor at UT Austin and has focused a lot of her research on the ethics of sustainable design, but has been very involved as well in practice and created a new program on design for a public workshop, design for public good. She's also participated in the Alley Flat Initiative, the Texas Gulf Coast Recovery Pilot Project, and the SEED Network that she's going to tell you a lot more about. To her left is John Peterson, who is the founder and president of Public Architecture, which is a nonprofit organization that mobilizes designers, including a lot of architects, to use their skills to drive social change. The 1% is a program of public architecture and has built a network of over 15,000 design professionals that John has helped to catalyze to provide more than $38 million worth of pro bono services across the country. So he's really innovating the way that designers leverage their talents and expertise in the service of the public good. And finally, to my right is Jess Zimbabwe, who is also a trained architect, but is currently the executive director of the Daniel Rose Center for Public Leadership and Land Use. And so she is involved in questions around land use, decision-making, and practices design and design thinking with public officials, including a lot of mayors, to think about how land and public space and other programs are made effective for the public good. So as we talked about what we wanted to get out of, what we hoped to get out of the session today, our goal was for all of you to leave excited about the concept of design thinking and maybe asking yourselves a little bit what you could do to practice this or test it or implement it in your lives. And so instead of an esoteric conversation splitting hairs over what is design, and some really remote questions like that, we wanted to get very tactical and very specific right away. So each of the panelists is actually going to take a few minutes to present to you one example of something they are super excited about in the realm of design thinking for social innovation or the public good, and then one example of something they're concerned about or they think is not going well. So with that, I think John is going to kick off, and we'll turn it to you.
All right. Hi, my name's John Peterson, and I may be winging this a bit because it appears that my computer has decided that this is the moment it's going to stay on one slot. But it's not a big problem because I'm only here to talk for 3 minutes about something that my organization is seeing as both an opportunity and some of the biggest barriers that we feel are out there. I wanted to talk or illustrate this through a project that we're doing with Habitat for Humanity. So Habitat for Humanity approached us about 18 months ago and said that one of the challenges that they had was the quality of the homes that they were able to build consistently. Habitat for Humanity right now is approximately the fourth largest home builder in the country. They have 1,600 affiliates nationwide. And in fact, they're larger internationally than they are here in the U.S. So that's just a portion of the work that they do. Those affiliates are independently managed and are not under the control of the mothership of Habitat for Humanity International. So we knew because of the reputation, as we've observed it, that the design profession, particularly the architecture profession, had about Habitat for Humanity, is that they weren't a very interesting client. They hadn't really invested in design. They hadn't made design a priority, and were very much focused on some you know, deeply important things, affordability. They had a new commitment to sustainability. But that design as a tool, it was not something that really was on their radar screen. And in fact, they came to us and asked for plans that they could hand out to their affiliates. And for architects, that's a troubling thing because all neighborhoods, all regions are different. So we said, because of who we are as an organization, we have this growing network of design professionals, designers of the built environment, I should point out. We felt that the best strategy was to begin to change the way designers saw Habitat for Humanity as a potential client and change the way their affiliates saw design as a productive tool to solve problems or to further their mission. So we decided to hand select seven architects around the country and match them up with select affiliates, and then use this as an example of, you know, a positive example of how designers could bring about, you know, could further the mission of an organization like this. So the good news is that four of those projects are underway and have been you know, by all measure to date, very successful. The downside is that three of those seven were failures by one example or another. And what was most engaging to us is they were failures of the sort that one would expect as soon as you saw them happen. We have a mission-based organization whose focus was very carefully defined, very rigorous, and in some cases bureaucratic. And when we brought in designers who were really trying to elevate the quality of housing, things like the increase of the budget by even 5 or 10% was seen as a threat to some of the fundamental goals that they had. At the same time, we had designers who were entering into marketplaces that they weren't unfamiliar with. So we had one design, very, very good national designer, who designed what they thought was a great solution, and the local community said, but that looks exactly like a double wide to us, and we have no interest in it. And so here was a designer, very skilled, but was unfamiliar with the culture that they were working in. So we were watching both the thrills of being able to engage the fourth largest home builder. At the same time, we were watching the limitations of our own profession and the limitations of organizations who were so narrowly defined. I'll give one more example, and then we can move on. But at one point, we were prepared to announce this partnership to the world. We got their head of PR on the line and talked about what that would look like, and they stated right up front that that in fact we were not able to use the name Habitat for Humanity International unless we gave them $100,000. So that was the cost of entry. We were bringing to them well over $100,000 in services, and if this was successful, we'd be bringing them millions of dollars in services. And I said, at what point can we actually say that we're doing a partnership with Habitat for Humanity International? And the response was, well, never, because design is not seen as a critical tool or a important enough resource that we would ever give it any value whatsoever. So that helped us illustrate not only the challenge that we had, But to be frank, the opportunity that was out there to work with organizations at this scale with that are so deeply focused on what is their bottom line.
Awesome. Thank you. Barbara, do you mind?
If your slides show, we can come back to them.
Yeah. What number?
That's okay.
It's not.
It's not critical at all. Oh, there we go.
Oh, do you want to just show the pictures?
Oh. For me?
Yeah.
Let me see if I can... I can do that quickly. Some stats, much of which you've already heard. These are some of the challenges that Habitat had. They have no design staff throughout their network, tight budgets, volunteer labor. This is the typical Habitat house, and this is what we were trying to improve. I'm just going to spin through. These are the four that are moving forward, the four design firms spread across the country, and I'm just going to give you a flavor. This is in Detroit, and this is Vincent James and Associates. And this is in Mississippi, and this is Skagen Elam.
Could you comment while you're showing the slides on, other than the changes in the form?
Yeah.
What were other innovations that involving these designers, what other innovations did it lead to in the...
Well, so this is in a floodplain. This is in Mississippi. This was part of the Katrina devastation area. And you can see a part of this house is elevated and a part of this house is lower to grade. There is great advantage to having your living level closer to the ground, but obviously not in a flood condition, so that half the house was above and half the house is below what is the 100-year flood mark. And so really they're looking at how do we improve livability, how do we bring natural light, how do we get a more dynamic family environment but still build at the sort of crushingly small budgets that Habitat builds for.
Well, and I think just to underscore what you just said, I mean, when we're talking about design for public good and for social innovation, those are really broad terms. So you just listed specifically three things that are social objectives that design can enhance, right?
Right.
Livability, family dynamics.
Right.
Those are some of the ends other than just a visual aesthetic that is preferred.
Yeah, we are not talking about design as a cultural vehicle to express the advancement of the conversation around design. If that makes sense, right?
What does that mean?
Well, it means that a lot of the conversation within architecture is about advancing the conversation of architecture. And that's a really important and interesting thing. But when it comes to serving these kinds of communities, that can be a background conversation, but the foreground conversation needs to be what do these clients need? What does this neighborhood need? How do we solve the really present and urgent problems that they face?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
I can make it so. I think actually through, can we do that through South By?
Yeah, I think
no
the Slide Rocket technology.
Yeah, I think that's actually on Slide Rocket. I think you can access it, but I can find out and make sure that it's available.
Yeah. Barbara, would you share your example?
Yeah, will you example mine up if you can?
I can, I think.
Thank you. I think it's already up.
Is it?
Yeah.
That one.
Yeah.
Oh, this is why. Oh, here we go.
There you go. Yeah. So in 3 minutes, what I'm most excited about is actually this growing conversation happening now about the ways in which green building could be thought about in a kind of expanded way. We talk a lot about sustainability, and sustainable development is supposed to be about ecology, economy, and equity. And often that's just not really the case. Sometimes it's economy and ecology, and sometimes it's just economy. And these things are problematic, to say the least, when you're sort of putting yourself out there and using it as a marketing tool to be green. And now I think there's a movement that we're all sort of a part of that's interested in really, okay, so what would, you know, these tenets of green building and sustainability, what would they look like if we're going to be applying them in a larger context? And so not only is it a critique of the sort of U.S. Green Building Council's LEED standard, but it's also, you know, saying like, okay, so it's okay to you know, evaluate buildings and evaluate projects that have an effect on our, you know, our world through checklists, but maybe they could at least be really thoughtful, inclusive checklists that have something to do with the place in which the buildings are actually built. And at the same time, there's this notion that we might democratize design, right? That it might not just be big A architecture for the sense of big A architecture, but we might actually give, the realms of people interested in using design as a tool to further their lives or their health or their education or whatever, the ability to do so with some online tools. So the SEED Network is something that several of us up here have been a part of trying to, at least a conversation around. This is their current little splash page on the website. It's really still something that's in evolution, which is kind of why I'm so excited about it. It's real open. There's a moment for any of you to sort of contribute to the conversation at the moment. It was named partially to add a social component onto what the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED standard is, which is, you know, leadership in environmental and I think it's what in energy, economic and energy design. And this is really trying to add the social component onto that. And so in some senses, it's just like a straight up critique. But in another sense, it's an online tool that gets you to really be thoughtful. So a community that's worried about a project happening in their neighborhood can go on and answer the questions that you sort of are led through as a part of this tool to help really kind of understand what's happening in the built world and help them articulate their concerns about a structure, or a developer could use it to really sort of say, this is what I'm promising, this is what I'm going to commit to you that I'm going to do. And then in the end, hopefully the community can say, okay, this is what you said you're going to do. Let's see these numbers that really quantify how you've benefited our community in some way. And right now, what I'm most excited about is getting the there's a myriad of these different groups that have sort of critiqued the green building, you know, standards in one way or another. And I think the next stage is actually getting them to all work together in some sort of dialogue and online toolkit to where you can choose from things like the Living Building Challenge, or the SEED Network, or the LEED standard, and use those technologies when they best suit your project. And really be an educational tool, a knowledge broker of sorts for these types of standards, and make it to where you're more accountable when you get kind of say, yes, this is a sustainable community, this is a sustainable building. Now there's some, hopefully at some point the tool will be refined enough and vetted through kind of, you know, your critique to where it's really, it's about, being accountable for the type of world we're creating. So that's what I'm most
excited
about.
Can I interject a question on this? So I think, you know, the traditional LEED evaluation criteria, it's fairly easy to assess the cost of a building. It's fairly easy to assess, you know, carbon emissions. You know, we're developing processes. But how do you assess social impact?
The community benefit agreements are the best standard out there right now. Community benefit agreements have been sort of filtered through this national network called the Partnership for Working Families. And they have 19 different, they're sort of an umbrella for 19 different local entities in different parts of the country. We don't have any in Texas because it's kind of a labor union, a driven thing. But these groups say, okay, so you want to build the Staples Center, That's wonderful. Mr. Developer, you're gonna benefit from this in a huge way. We want our community to benefit as well. So it's community-based, which is why it's so hard to have a national standard for something so intensely local. But it comes through a process. That's what the Seed Network is trying to sort of put out there, where it says, okay, we want jobs, and we want them to be good, healthy, green jobs with benefits. We want a playground for our community. These sorts of things where hopefully it's a win-win, when the developer gets to feel like they're doing something that's really valuable to the community, and at the same time, the community really finds ownership and empowerment and an articulation of what they really do need. That's the best model out there, and I think the hope is that this tool will help folks that can't necessarily, they're not necessarily within the framework of a community benefit agreements model, which is really legally, kind of driven, but they want the same set of tools.
Okay. Did you have an example of something you're most concerned about?
I think I'm it's sort of this flip side. I'm most concerned about using these terms, and even just this social justice framework of the design world, which is it's pretty hip right now. Using them to sort of claim that you're doing something good, when in the long run, you're doing something problematic, or you didn't actually address the needs of the community. You just sort of made a pretty design and took a lot of the grant money that could potentially be going to that area, and then didn't actually build something that the community truly benefited from. And I think they need to be involved in that process in order for that to happen. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that every designer has that in mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, we might talk more about that.
Yeah,
Jess.
Sure, thanks. My work is a little bit tangential to the design question in that we don't talk about it as design. I work at a nonprofit called the Urban Land Institute, and I run a program there to a training and leadership development program for public officials, local government officials in the United States, mayors, city council people, and their direct appointees, planning directors, housing directors, transportation directors, and the like. And we run a year-long training program where we work with them in a fellowship situation over the course of the year, where they get together and talk about the major land use challenges that they're facing in their community, about transportation, about new development, about building new jobs and bringing them to their community. So I think of, personally, because I'm trained as an architect and as a city planner, I think of a lot of what we do is we bring design thinking and the models of design thinking to them and to their work. We don't talk about that. We don't ever talk to them that we're going to teach you how to do design thinking or create space in your daily life or your work life where you can do that design thinking. And I think it's partly a similar scenario to what you were talking about, John, with Habitat for Humanity, where I don't think they would see the value of design. If we sold our program as we're going to teach you how to do design thinking and bring that to your work, that doesn't bring any kind of credential to an elected official, to city government. That's not something that's valuable. It's not reducing the crime rate. It's not reducing the deficit, bringing jobs to their community, the ways that they could sell their participation in this program to the community. So we don't talk about design thinking, and when they choose to participate in our program, they have to give some time and to come to our retreats and our sessions, and that's how they sell it to their citizens. They sell it by saying, we're going to go learn from the Urban Land Institute about how to bring economic development to our community, how to bring new jobs. We're bringing new transportation, new projects, new hotel development downtown. But the reason I think of it as bringing design thinking to it is because these folks, especially the electeds, but even the next level down of appointeds, tend to be incredibly decisive. They tend to be very analytic thinkers, and they tend to be really quick judges of public perception. They can change their thinking and their decision-making very quickly because they can perceive how quickly public opinion is turning for or with them on a project. All of those are very powerful things for getting cities built and getting projects built and implemented. So all of our cities are better for that system of government that we have. But none of those really produce the kind of thoughtful design process for thinking about why your city got to be the way that you're building it that in the design professions is taught. So
can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Like, what are some of the different things?
Yeah, sure. And this is some of the things I think we try to build space for for the teams to work on during our retreats. We talk about the work being research-based. We take all of the teams of fellows to other cities to see other projects where they can kick the tires and, examine, well, that street works like this when it has a streetcar running down the middle of it. Could our street back at home work the same way? Mm-hmm. And that's something that, public officials, especially in an era of budget austerity, don't always have the opportunity to do, to be able to see that that kind of, you know, on-site research of another place and bring that example. We also work, because we bring a team from each city, we ask the mayor to nominate his or her senior team to bring with them through the fellowship. It's interdisciplinary and it's collaborative, and that's something that's also not usually the case for the way that decisions are made in the mayor's office or in city council chambers. You don't often see the housing director and the transportation director in a city getting to spend a day together thinking about a problem, and we bring that opportunity to them by asking them to work on that land use challenge together. Our program, because we create this safe space for these retreats and these discussions with their peers from other cities, also we don't make any early judgments. You know, as you're sort of ideating in that collaborative, interdisciplinary way, anything's on the table. It really promotes outside-of-the-box thinking that many of us in this room are pretty comfortable with. That's not something that's usually something they're very comfortable with, because they're so quickly having to respond to however public opinion is shaping. So they start to, before they even finish their sentence, they can sort of tell how the room is reading what they're about to say, and they can change their opinion. But that that fear of failure can lead them to not always come up with the best idea. So we try and create the space for that. And finally, you know, I think good design work comes out of not always doing what's popular. And especially when you're designing a city, those are very long-term decisions. Where roads, buildings, transit lines go are things that may not make fiscal sense in this year's budget, but are, you know, going to be on the city's land for 25, 50, or longer years. So it's important to for them to have that space to think of what the best solution is, and to be able to realize that when they implement it, it may not be immediately popular, and they're going to have to figure out how to sell that to their decisionary as a longer-term investment. So you asked for one thing that excites me and one thing that worries me. One thing that excites me is that I think that we are facing a real era where government is really open to the idea of rethinking the role of what government is and should be. And I think you see that here, and you look at, if you look through the interactive panels today, a lot of sessions about Gov 2.0 and the open data. We're seeing a real huge amount of open data becoming available and transparency in the way that government works. And you know, one example would be Google Transit. Google Transit getting access to cities and transit agencies' data. So Portland Metro, I think, was the first transit authority that made their data available to Google Maps, so you can, you know, get your transit directions on when you're doing mapping between two places. And now most major cities have that. There are a few that haven't gotten over their hang-ups about it. And for every city that's done that, they've gotten, you know, many-fold leveraged private sector investments of apps that have been built that make their system work better, that the city, the transit agency, wasn't doing on their own anyways. So I think that's a real revolution and a positive thing. I also think that because we're rethinking what is the appropriate role of government and what the private sector can also bring to government with that use of government data, it's a real opportunity for designers to become involved in these civic engagements. And I say that a lot when I'm speaking to audiences of designers of the built environment, like John was saying, architects, planners, landscape architects. But I think there's also a lot of room, and you'll see that also at South By, for other designers, for user interface designers, database designers. You know, Code for America is going to be talking later today. Programs like that that allow all kinds of people who have these kind of design thinking skills to bring that into that civic engagement is a great opportunity. What worries me, I think, if I can squeeze in two here, my one worry is sort of this Tea Party theme of constrained government in general, and sort of a fear of government as a source of public good. And I think that's really challenging, because I think of government as what we do collectively that we can't do on our own. And so, you know, in a tight economic era, to have a rhetoric of making government even smaller, I think is challenging. When you think about the possibility of the government expanding and making their data open, can leverage all this additional private sector interest from the design community. That's troublesome. But I think for the purpose of the design community and into the context of this Gov 2.0, this conversation that's happening, another worry that I have is that there's so much data out there that it can be hard to interpret all of that raw data. And when governments don't have the resources to make that sort of legible to citizens and decision makers, I worry that can turn people off and make them disengage. You know, if it becomes a full-time job to become an informed citizen because there's so much data out there, mm-hmm. that's when people start to disengage from those civic decision mm-hmm. processes. So mm-hmm. I hope we can overcome that.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think something, so we have here an example of more traditional built environment architecture and innovation in a product, even though it's a house, right, a structure. And then, Barbara, your example is really an innovation in a framework, so coming up with a set of evaluation criteria that try to then as a secondary benefit, drive innovations in a product. And then, Jess, your design example is actually a process, right? So engaging people in a certain format of a conversation that leads to different outcomes. So insofar as, you know, the people here in this room and at South by Southwest are very interested in, you know, sort of 2.0, what comes next, whether that's on the web, in social media, on mobiles, in government, in communities, what is the common language here? What are the lessons, or what is the technique or the theme that's common to these three very different examples that someone else could take and begin to implement as they're working on 2.0 of whatever they are passionate about, right? So how can design thinking be about product, framework, and process all at the same time? What's common in those three things? And I didn't prepare them with that question. So.
Well, I think one of the things you heard is that, at least from Jess and myself, is that the language that we use to introduce these ideas, we have to watch very carefully. And that design is a term that's tossed around as if we understand its meaning. I don't even think the design community fully understands its meaning, and certainly outside of the design community, it's not well understood. And if you aren't relating those efforts back to some result that's shared more globally, then I think we're really only talking amongst a small group of people, and it really hampers our effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the conversation internally isn't a really important one and a good one, but that there are appropriate times to use that yeah. internal language.
I mean, definitely agree. I think that the design community, and I mean that broadly, I'm most familiar with the architecture and urban design sort of world, but I think that also about sort of the environment design and app design and everything world is a little bit too into talking to itself. And, you know, so, I mean, I used to run a very similar program where I also worked with public officials, did very similar work. It was called the Mayor's Institute on City Design. And that was a much sexier program title within the design community. That was cool. Every designer or architect who heard about that work said, ooh, I want to be a part of that. That sounds really cool. And it was hard to sell the mayors on why they should come. Because mayors heard Mayors and Student City Design and thought, oh, that's sort of arts, and I'll go do that when I have time. But they didn't make it a priority. And so we very consciously, in choosing the name of this program, didn't use the word design because we didn't want to be that easily dismissed. But in the... Do you know what I'm saying? In the design community, there's a lot of attention. I think you were saying to it before about designers talking to designers about advancing the next idea, but not necessarily proving the value of design outside of that community more broadly.
Okay, well, let's just back up for 1 second because I want to come back to that. But you, in your examples, did reference design thinking skills, and you know, you talked about a lot of different kinds of designers, UI designers, you know, app designers, as well as architects, product designers. And so there must be some common set of skills or a common way of approaching problems that's implicit in what you're saying that we just haven't made explicit. Can you elaborate, I mean, on what that means to you? I mean, what is the common skill set of all these people? What is it that we're valuing here?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know how much of it I think it is innate and how much of it is taught during the processes of design training. I think some of the things that I tried to talk about before, the idea of being interdisciplinary and collaborative, the idea of taking a step back and a longer-term approach to a problem, which is one problem we run into with public officials. They're incredibly busy, and most of their day revolves around putting fires out. So for a mayor, a planning director, a city council person to have more than 15 or 20 minutes to devote to any given topic or content piece in a moment's time is extraordinary. And that's not really how the kind of outside-of-the-box, aha moment thinking that we think of that comes out of design doesn't fit very well into that kind of your schedule if your day is broken up into 10-minute increments of putting out fires.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see, I think, you know, when you look at Code for America even, though the Code for America fellows are not, they don't have a desk in City Hall. They're not based there. They go and they learn and they listen very intensively for the city's problems and what resources the city has available, and then they go away and sort of focus on their design mode of thinking of coming up with a computer app that helps the city organize their snow plowing better or whatever it is, whatever their project is, and then they come back and present that to the city. So it's almost like you do need this ability to retreat from the craziness of the the pace of the bureaucratic thinking in a city mm-hmm. to allow that design thinking to. So I'm trying to think of how you describe that kind of thinking that sure. you have to go away and retreat to do.
Yeah. Barbara, do you have a comment from the perspective? I mean, you're teaching this. Yeah. Uh-huh. So what are you teaching?
Yeah. I'm really passionate about teaching in an interdisciplinary setting, which half the time you're teaching about translation. You know, that is really the key point. You cannot be successful if you're not conveying ideas in really dynamic but also simple, I don't want to say that, you know, but clear terms. And it's amazing how each one of our little niches, even within this type of a community in which, you know, we all come from similar sorts of backgrounds, it's amazing how different the language is, you know. I'm sure there's a few of you going like, I don't use that word that way at all. I mean, Susie even had to sort of define what design was going to be for the, you know, purposes of this panel. And so even, I mean, I operate within a school of architecture in which we have urban planners, urban designers, architects, of course, interior designers, and a few other, you know, fields. And they are wildly different, even the language that they use and the approaches that they use to certain problems. And then there's this whole notion of just how to, and this is really something that John's sort of speaking to as well, but how to sort of argue for the value of a thoughtful process. You know, I mean, it's really what Jess is saying as well. There's, you have to make it known why you're useful mm-hmm. In the world, right? And I think we're now in a very fast-paced community in which, we want data, we want numbers, and we want it today. Mm-hmm. And so we spend a lot of time. I work at a research center that really spends a lot of time thinking about how to articulate that that's translatable to lots of different languages. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we open up right now for some questions from the audience? I've got a few more, but yeah, or I don't think I'm allowed to call. I think the microphone person selects.
There are roving people with microphones to grab their attention.
So you touched a little bit about the interaction of technology with design and for cities. Can you talk a little bit more about technologies like, you know, cameras for public safety or sensors for environmental information, how that's influencing your design, if at all?
Jess?
Yeah.
You can say no.
I know because I work with a lot of city people that they're talking about those kind of things, but I'm generally working on a scale of project where we're not talking about that scale of intervention. I know that a lot of cities are seeing, you know, dramatic decreases in the crime rate because of cameras downtown, but generally I'm working with them on, like, you know, large mixed-use development, so we're not talking at that level, that scale of technology. So I'm going to have to think about if I can come up with another example.
Is there another question from the audience?
That's a good question.
Some in the front here on this side.
Thank you. My organization is about to begin the process of creating a community garden, and we're working very closely with the city to sort of fund and oversee some of the design of this project. But the nature of a community garden is that it's for and of the community. So can you talk a little about some of the strategies that you've used or tools that you have to get regular people who get on the bus every day and go to work to become part of the discussion of what this garden might look like or how they want to use it.
Or part of any design process.
Yeah, yeah, it's a ongoing struggle. There's an entire group of designers who refer to themselves as community-based designers. We as an organization are sort of a bit of an alternative, but we sort of look at that a little bit differently than the community-based design community does. But this question is a terribly vexing one. And, the way we would look at it is that you want to use lots of different tools to get input, and online tools. There's a growing number of online tools and software that you can employ so that people can comment not only in a group setting but also independently. Those are, I think, quite powerful. I do think meeting with in a group continues to be one of the most important tools, but it's terribly limiting who you can get to show up, so to speak. And then I think there's a very interesting debate about who's the designer. There's a lot of folks who would say what we want to do is empower the users to be the designer, and that the designer is the, you know, the professional is really facilitating that process. I think that's one argument. That's a traditional community-based design process argument. I would personally take another point of view of that, and I would. This came up in conversation earlier. I come out of private practice where I was serving very wealthy clients. And we never gave over our responsibility as the designer, and I think we would have been fired had we ever said, oh, we're not the designer, you are, all we're doing is facilitating you. And I believe deeply in the intent behind that, which is how do we make people feel empowered and so they can participate. My rich clients felt empowered, I promise you, and didn't have to worry about that. But you do have to worry about that in a broader community. But I think what you really need to do is just listen very, 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 very hard to what people say, what they want. Get them to say beyond what they think they're supposed to say. Get them to say beyond what they want to what they need. And in the need part, often are the most interesting issues and the best solutions.
I just want to interject an example. Earlier when we were talking about this, we felt that there might be a useful analogy to think about how medicine has evolved and changed, where, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, you know, you went to your doctor and kind of saw them as this ultimate expert, and you came in with very little pre-existing knowledge about what was wrong or what you thought the solutions might be, and whatever they told you, you just did, right? Versus now, we all look at our doctors in a very different light. We take much, much greater involvement in our own personal health, reading up about whatever your symptoms might be, maybe trying to bring in naturopathic or other types of solutions. But then you might still engage a doctor because, you know, if you can't figure it out, or you may need, you know, a combination. And so maybe that is kind of the path that we're on with design, where we're not looking ultimately to rid the world of doctors or architects, but to have a more interactive and dynamic engagement so that maybe you don't have to go to the doctor as often, and communities are more empowered to participate and lead design on their own, but in sophisticated problems or whenever is necessary, they can engage really extreme professional designers to come in and help them. Right. So, Barbara.
Like,
yeah.
House.
Yeah,
you have
like
a real
house.
Medical problem, you need Dr. House. You
know, totally.
Yeah.
Can we flip back to John's computer? One of the things we do in my little center at UT is we run a summer program that does the sort of thing you're actually talking about, in terms of like we engage students around action-based research, so they're doing real projects. They're typically at a slightly smaller scale than a community garden, because, as you know, that takes more than 9 weeks. But last year it was actually just a 5-week session. We had students from all over the world come and participate, and they got to know the community by doing small service projects. Not necessarily that wasn't necessarily the intention, but they made friends like Mrs. Rios, who you see down there on the bottom, you know, near the bottom right-hand side. She needed a ramp, and so they felt like it was a valid use of their time to build her a ramp, and they were learning through that process. So I highly recommend that that you, in order to engage the community, actually showing them that you are listening and you're ready to be of service to them through action is one of the best things you can do. We started the Alley Fund Initiative by cleaning up alleys and just being like, okay, we have some very preliminary designs here, but we want to know what you think. And of course, food is always required at all events everywhere, you know, so feed people and maybe set up some hopscotch and have a day of service where you're doing something that they have told you they need, not just what you think they need, but what they've told you they need. Mm-hmm. And then we did projects that were sort of urban agriculture in nature, which is why I thought to show them. here, and we used an approach called asset-based design. So we were engaging, first we flyered the neighborhood that we were working with, and we had a pre-existing relationship with a few of the organizations that served that neighborhood. And we said, hey, we want to work with you. We, you know, you're going to have to come to a lot of meetings. You're going to have to, like, give of your time. But in the long run, this is going to be something where students, you know, who knows what wacky thing they're going to come up with, but they're going to build it, and it's going to be in, you know, in the public space around your house within the next 5 weeks. So if you're prepared for that, call us. And we had an amazing amount of response. The city's actually really interested in reimagining what the alleyways might look like themselves. Other cities have alley regeneration type projects, and the city wanted to know what Austin's version might be. So I was really, you know, I had my little agenda that I was putting on onto alleys, and we did find a set of neighbors that all sort of replied. And they'd never met each other, but they all replied and said, yeah, that sounds really cool to me, in the same alley. So we did do one of those projects, which I'll go to in a second, that started a broader conversation now. But it was really limited in scope in terms of what the first intervention might be. So I think that's nice. I mean, people get real, community members don't like to be told, you know, we're going to do this thing and it's going to be great and you're going to love it because of this. So community asset-based design actually allows you to really take the time to think about what their assets are. You know, so you have to listen very intently and, you know, genuinely to people to hear, okay, so I do this well. I'm a stonemason. And so, you know, I'm interested in, you know, using my skills in this way or that. You know, really thinking about, okay, so there's people in almost every neighborhood in Austin that are, you know, really good cooks, right? But what do they cook? What types of things do they cook? You know, thinking about, like, you might grow what the community, you know, wants to eat. And but you've got to have a whole, you know, collaborative sort of design-like process to even get to that conversation. And then you know, you come up with things that actually speak to community needs. In this case, 5 Mile Farm is a group that that wants to have micro farms all over the community within a 5 mile radius of Austin, so that people have access to fresh food. And they needed bikeable farm stands. So this is a larger farm stand, but they also built a small farm stand that you could tote on the back of your bike, so that each alley had access to fresh food. And, you know, I mean, I think listening allows for innovations like that. In this case, the group wanted to build some really cool sort of chicken coop type thing, but the painter on the property actually needed a shed. So they made this sort of shed that could then, you know, had a chicken coop, because he did have these chickens that didn't have homes living in his property. So they got a home in the process, but also he had a place to put all of his tools. And it was made out of recycled materials that needed kind of a life afterwards. So there's sort of shipping panels. But the Alley Regeneration Project is probably the most appropriate example for your project. It's coming out of this sort of desire to have food production all across the city. But a lot of people, you know, really like their public space, you know, unprogrammed, because then they can play soccer when they, you know, when they want a soccer game, or they really want to grow a type of food that that isn't actually totally appropriate for our climate. And so I think a lot of that is it's just a dialogue, you know. And I mean, I know that sounds really simple and kind of silly, but
But actually, I think that is part of why design thinking is becoming so popular right now. It's part of this shift in terms of how we solve public problems, away from a 20th century model, which was dominated by nation states, the World Bank, public policy students, and MBAs that, you know, just went through the educational system, examined problems from an academic and analytic perspective, and then came up with policy prescriptions about how to resolve them. And now, eureka, we've come to this moment where, like, actually, you might want to go and spend some time with the community and ask them, you know, what they really need,
right.
Which, you know, seems obvious, but is actually going to be a fairly big sea change. And maybe, you know, you've seen some of that already in the cities that you work with in how we solve public problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about the previous question, too, about sort of security cameras. Is the security camera question guy still here?
Yeah.
Yes. Very good. So just thinking, I live in Washington, D.C., and this is sort of a design thinking solution that folks came up with in D.C. not for security cameras so much, but speed cameras. They have speed traps around Washington, D.C. And at first, they just had one camera facing the back of the car to take a picture of your license plate. And it would capture how fast you were going and then take a picture of the license plate, because that's what they need to legally say that your vehicle was above the speed limit at this time. But they found that people were fighting those tickets in court, saying, I wasn't driving my car, I wasn't on that road, it wasn't me, whatever. So they installed a second camera facing the other direction, who then captures a picture of who's driving the car. And it's recognizable. So like, oh, is this you driving your car, sir? And then, you know, it's harder to fight the ticket. So they found that there was a dramatic drop in the rate of people fighting those speeding tickets when they had the front. But then once they had those two pieces of data, someone in city government thought about it and thought, what else could we do with these two photographs now that we have it? And so they decided to run those against the stolen vehicle database in the city. And now the stolen vehicle rate, they've captured like 80 or 90% of stolen vehicles within 24 hours of them being stolen, because there are 24 of these locations around the city, and inevitably if you steal a car, you drive by one. And then they've got a picture of the stolen vehicle license plate and the person who's driving it that they can compare against their database of known criminals or whatever example. It is. So, yeah.
How about another question from the audience? Oh, waiting right there.
Barbara just touched upon the theme of the question I was going to ask. But this is for John. John, you mentioned about the challenges you had with Habitat for Humanity in recognizing what design was offering. So in that case, using that as an example, how did you manage to convince them and see your viewpoint?
The simple answer is we didn't, in fact, convince them. And I think that's a very long road. And I showed that example because we're in the middle of the sort of, you know, working with Habitat for Humanity. And they've had one foot in, one foot out. There have been people at that organization who've been very committed to this idea, and there are others that still don't see it. The solution for us was not to try to win over the Habitat for Humanity organization, the headquarters. The issue for us was to win over the 1,600 affiliates, or enough of them that then they would demonstrate to the larger organization that this was a value. So we didn't have to convince the handful of people at the leadership level at Habitat. We could go to the people on the ground getting the work done, who they value what they think the organization values very much, what the affiliates are doing and what they think. So we simply just looked at it as a grassroots opportunity. We're very fortunate because you don't normally have that as an option, but because of the way that organization is structured, we could do that. So we didn't actually miss a step when they said, you actually can't tell the world that you're doing with us, even though you are, and we acknowledge internally you can't tell others, which was a very interesting dynamic. And we were able to just move on quickly because we then focused on the affiliates, which we were focused on anyway. But I'm guessing we're probably talking about a 5 or 10 year process. You know, if we really want to look back and say, Habitat for Humanity is now producing some of the best housing at that cost point of anybody in the world, and that's probably probably 10 years away, mm-hmm. if we're lucky.
Another question.
I'm really interested to bring it back to this question of aesthetics, because this is something that I'm struggling with. And John, you mentioned that one of the designs was rejected because it resembled a double-wide trailer, and that was aesthetically not what the user was interested in. So I teach in an MFA communication design program and set up a collaborative project between my students and a local school. A lot of opportunity in this project. It was about raising awareness of the school and crossing a language barrier between the students of the school and the surrounding community. And we did some really interesting work just immersing ourselves in the community and doing different workshops with the different groups within the school. And so my students came up with a few different solutions. One of them I thought was really progressive, forward-thinking, design solution. Another one, I was a little disappointed with my students because I felt like they hadn't pushed it. The school really liked the latter, and it came down to a question of taste, mostly. I thought that both of the solutions solved the needs. So then I was struggling with myself. Am I just being elitist? Am I, you know, do I have the wrong standards? The question, I guess, is you talked about when you're discussing the problem with the client up front or the collaborator, community collaborator up front, you're not looking for what they want but what they need. does that also come into play in the end product? Could you say that?
Or what are the criteria with which we judge good design?
Right.
Is it a purely programmatic, functional
right.
question? Is there an aesthetic element that maybe the client may not even understand?
In private practice, when I am working with an elite client, we do still push the, whether it's the Art Institute of Chicago or who it is, we are still pushing them aesthetically. And so I feel like, gosh, if we're pushing a community partner aesthetically, maybe it's not elitist, it's the same that we would do for a client
okay.
who's
yeah,
paying
Yeah, let's give them a chance to respond to that.
I don't think we have a lot of broad-based design education in this country. And that's more than just, I mean, I don't mean everybody should have a master's of architecture. That's crazy, right? And that's even more snobby than Rick Santorum accused Barack Obama of being, right? But even like broadly design appreciation. I mean, people think about taking a music appreciation or a wine appreciation course. And I don't know who's at fault, you know, if it's designers in particular for not doing enough to explain what good design means to the general public or just general educational professionals, that we don't consider that a valid part of a well-rounded curriculum for K-12 education even. But certainly designers could do more about it, even if it ultimately belongs back in K-12.
Can we be a little more provocative in terms of like how much is appropriate to push on the client? So we talked a lot about the value of client-centric design, listen to what your client needs, you know, don't come in with a preset agenda. But if your client is telling him, hey, I just want a, you know, chicken coop that's made from 2x4s, can you get this thing up for me? And you're like, wait a second, like how much is appropriate to push back on the client to insist on a certain level of aesthetic quality that they may not value?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer. Beauty has value, but that interpretation of beauty shifts a bit. So that's something to keep in mind, I think, and I think people appreciate that beauty has value, and you say this needs to be beautiful as part of our goal, and that's something to keep in conversation. The other thing is that I think it's important to keep in mind is that we service a very narrow culture in this country, very narrow culture. It doesn't take much to step outside of our cultural slot and realize that we really aren't talking the same language about beauty any longer. That doesn't mean we can't continue to lead, and that should be an upfront conversation about we want to actually provide for you something that is beyond what you're asking for. But how far beyond, I think, needs to be the careful consideration of the designer and maybe the careful consideration of the client.
Don't you think it, even when it gets to the point of a conversation with a client about a real project, it's almost too late? I mean, shouldn't that happen further upstream, that there's some level of understanding of what design quality is, which includes some level of aesthetic appreciation? And I don't think there's quite a bright line between the aesthetic appreciation and the more functional things that make design good, you know, from environmental or keeping the rain out kind of perspectives.
Yeah. Well, there's an obvious
difference. Isn't it too late when you're already at the conversation with the client? You're sort of in their hand. You know, you can't push a client too much because they're paying you.
Yeah,
you.
Right.
Couldn't we imagine a world where we evolved to...
Well, I mean, we can go to other countries.
Yeah, I was just saying, Europe.
And
you can imagine a world called Europe.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to Scandinavia, and there's
exactly.
a level of shared understanding of design thought that we simply can't quite fathom here.
Right. So I wonder if waiting until we're having a conversation with the client is too late.
Well, it is in one sense too late, although it's happening now, and we have to address that. And there's some version of that in you know, no matter how sophisticated the general population is, there's some version of that. How far do we push this? What's appropriate? Are we being asked to push this? You know, wealthy private clients often want to push the envelopes on aesthetic judgment. And those are really exciting projects for designers. But that's a rarefied group of people.
So... Yeah,
absolutely valid. And so I'd argue it's your responsibility to push the client.
So we've got 2 minutes left, or probably a minute now. Right. Do you mind taking up the final word on this from your experience with maybe some of the summer projects or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's a responsibility to push the client towards something they need. I think part of something being beautiful is that it's functional and that it serves their needs in a certain way. I obviously, you know, you said that both of your projects had the same, like, they were addressing the need in an appropriate way. I think we also have to remember, though, that taste has historically had, you know, class connotations associated with it. So we're all talking as if there is one beauty, and there's just not. And so the worst case scenario is, so the Alley Flat Initiative built these little Alley Flats you see here are all designs that the students at our architecture school were designing for and with community members. And the shed roof was a really popular design for a lot of our architecture students. And we talked with one mother of three, you know, who had, like, you know, what you'd expect. She wants more storage. She wants a place to barbecue. You know, these sorts of things in her very small home. And we said, what do you think about the shed roof? It's really, you know, it's good for your energy performance. It's good for rainwater catchment. And she said, you know, it's beautiful, but it's not for me because I can't hang Christmas lights on something like that. And of course you can hang Christmas. I mean, it's not like the Christmas lights would fall off because it's a shed roof, but it was just for her, beauty is something, you know, a home is something that has a certain iconic symbol to it, and no matter if the School of Architecture thinks that there's something else that's more beautiful and more interesting and pushing the envelope, she still needs to feel comfortable hanging her Christmas lights.
Yeah. Awesome.
That's a great example.
Well, please join me in thanking our panelists, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.